First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Local activists say they've had enough of attacks on public education. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with a new group vowing to defend public schools. What are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, why Amelia Island residents are speaking out against a proposed development there. That's later in the hour. But first this morning, proposed book bans, limits on the teaching of American history, new rules for LGBTQ kids. A coalition of grassroots groups is forming to protest what's going on in public schools. We begin the hour with Dr. Jen Cowart of the group Public School Defenders. She's on the line with more. Dr. Cowart, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
We should note you've also been part of another group, Doctors Fighting COVID. As we talk, though, about schools today, we want your calls, 549-2937, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, already getting Facebook comments. So there are a couple of groups that are forming in the area, Public School Defenders and Moms for Humanity. Tell us about these groups.
Yeah, I think we started seeing the same problems arise and started organizing a little bit separately, now trying to see if we can merge our groups. But two things really bothering us, one being this rise in book banning and the banning of approved curriculum for really, in my mind, inappropriate concerns about this curriculum. And the second being the loss of support for our LGBTQ students. So parents across Duval and St. John's are really concerned about these things and wanting to work together to try to solve this problem and protect our students and ultimately defend our public schools.
Yeah, today the St. John's County School Board is holding a public hearing about people objecting to quite a few books in libraries in that county. And so your group is called Public School Defenders. Do you see public schools as being under attack?
I do. I think that there's a lot of concern right now being raised about this book or that book. We're seeing book bans across the country, including across Florida and in our neighboring county of St. John's. But we've also seen just a rise in attacks on our public schools, calls for people saying that our public schools are not wisely spending their money. We've got more and more voucher programs funneling public school money into private schools. Ultimately, what concerns me is that the right to a good public education is under attack. I benefited from public education all the way through medical school. I want my children and their children to have that same benefit, and other kids as well. And I think that the harder that these groups make it to teach or have your kids attend public schools, the more that gets to that program of siphoning money into the private school space and makes our public schools weaker and less able to defend themselves.
So you're talking about book bans, the Stop Woke Act, which limits actually the accurate teaching of American history in schools. What is your group's position on Duval County Public Schools' new guidelines for LGBTQ kids? In order to comply with state law, they've had to rework those guidelines. Critics say they amount to stripping protections for that student population.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do understand that there's a state law that needs compliance, but I've read both the prior guide document, which was nearly 40 pages long, and the current proposed document, which is only about 8 pages. And it really strips out a lot of very robust information that would have helped protect a particularly marginalized and vulnerable group. And of course, I'm talking about LGBTQ students. So the previous guide had a lot of great info for teachers and staff about how to protect a student who's coming out. What does that mean? Has a lot of definitions, a lot of information about how to protect a student. The new guide removes a lot of that info, doesn't really provide that same level of education around particularly sensitive issues like coming out. And then the framing of a lot of the other activities in the new proposed guide are really around parents. It's really around only protecting parents' rights and ignoring the fact that many of these students may be at risk of abuse at home, and not introducing that subtlety into the conversation. So while I understand there's a legal question here, I am very concerned that we've lost a lot of the comprehensive support that our LGBTQ students enjoyed under the previous guide, and that we're replacing it with this mantra of quote-unquote parents' rights, and we're going to then lose some support for the students who are at risk.
What are your questions for Dr. Jen Coward of the new group Public School Defenders? Give us a call, 549-2937. Janet at the Beaches. Hi, Janet.
Hey, how are you doing this morning?
Good.
I am so glad that this group is coming out. You know, I was sitting here, these right-wing conspiracy theorists, that this movement with these Moms for Liberty is being, the power behind that is Steve Bannon. These people go on his show on the War Room, and he's telling them to
podcast.
Take over the school
boards.
And he's, they're trying to get elected to the school board so they can push their agenda. They want to destroy the school system, the public school system, in favor of privatization. That is the agenda, and we have to stop them. We have to support our public schools. Because these private schools, I'll tell you right now, people think it's so great. Well, guess what? Those private schools have waiting lists. They do not have to accept your child, and they don't have to keep your child. They could just say, we don't want your child, and out they go. So if we destroy our public school system, we're going to be at the mercy of privatization. And we really got to fight hard. We have to get out. These people are running for the school board in Jacksonville. We got a whole bunch of them. We have to make sure they don't get elected to the school board because they're just a bunch of troublemakers. And I'm so glad this group, I want to know where to find you guys so I can get active with you.
Janet, thanks for the call. Okay, so two follow-ups for you, Jen Coward. One, will your group, Public School Defenders, be weighing in on some of the local school board races that are taking shape? Voters will be choosing between candidates who fall more on your side of the equation, defenders of traditional public schools, and candidates that might be aligned with groups like Moms for Liberty or others. So that's question one for you. Will you be getting involved in these races?
That's a great question. So we're not a 501c3 or a PAC or, you know, anything like that. So we're not going to be able to raise money or endorse in any race. But that said, one thing we do have on our plan is to host some meet and greets later this summer with school board candidates who we feel are more interested in defending public schools from these various attacks. And I share the previous caller's concerns. As you said, Melissa, I started with the doctors fighting COVID. I attended a lot of school board meetings to, you know, speak up for things like masks in schools when we were at the height of the COVID pandemic. And I saw firsthand some of this really heated and extreme rhetoric around not only not wanting masks in schools, but then, you know, more or less just attacking the public schools and saying they're not spending our money wisely. They're indoctrinating our kids into some kind of extremism. And so it's the same group that was anti-mask, that's anti-vax, and who's now in here trying to scream about book bans. So I agree, it's the same group. So yes, we'll be hosting some meet and greets so that community members can hear from school board candidates and then make up their minds. And we hope to get people out to the ballot box.
Now, to the second part of that caller's question, how do people get in touch with your organization?
So we have a Facebook page. It's Public School Defenders Duval. It should be available. Anybody can find it. And our next activity that we're going to be putting together is attending the June 7th DCPS school board meeting. That coincides with Pride Month. And so we're asking everybody who can to come out to the school board at 5 p.m. rally in the parking lot for Pride, and then sign in to go and speak to the school board during public comment and just tell people what it means to you to be there during Pride Month and what it would mean to public school students to have those really robust and comprehensive support from the previous LGBTQ support guide and not throw out a lot of that comprehensive support.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page. Elizabeth writes, I hear that teachers are taking all of the books out of their classrooms because they are afraid they will be sued for having improper material. This does children a great disservice, she says. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Jen Cowart with the new group Public School Defenders. What are your thoughts about the battle over education in Florida and the nation? 549-2937. Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. I was just kind of curious, back when the whole book banning topic kind of came to light in Florida, you know, a month or so ago, I went online and I found what appeared to be a law, if you will, that even though the state of Florida may say the following books are not on our approved book list, it's still up to the local school districts. In up to 50% of the case or of books can be selected by the local school district. So even though technically it may not be on the state list, if the school district still chooses to have a book out there, they can. So if that is the case, I'm just curious if your guest says or believes, well, maybe this is a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill kind of thing, because it appears to me the schools could still choose, in large part, some books that the state itself says, we don't really want it on our list.
Thanks, Mark. Jen Cowart.
That's a great question. I don't believe that there's a specific list that the state, you know, is trying to promote and then push down on the local school boards. I do think local school boards and even local schools have control here. But what we're seeing is a lot of fear on behalf of schools, teachers, libraries, and school boards and school districts across the state who are not sure what the boundaries are under these particular bills that passed this last session. So the Don't Say Gay bill and that Stop Woke Act, schools themselves would be liable potentially if a parent or community member chose to file suit around one of these pieces of curriculum or a book being quote-unquote not in compliance. So I think right now, because these bills are vague and because they're new, schools are reacting in ways to try to protect themselves. There's school districts in Broward County where they removed access to computer-based curriculum like Epic and Prodigy because they felt they couldn't verify that all the content was in line with new state law. And so they were removing access to resources that students benefit from because the school board is worried about a potential lawsuit. Mm. And so it's this this atmosphere of fear and worry where no one is really sure yet where the lines are going to be drawn. And so people are reacting in ways that are unpredictable right now. And so I think you could be right. It could be a mountain out of molehill. But we are seeing, again, book bans happening right now, proposed book bans, St. John's. We don't want that in Duval. We want access to books in our libraries. And I do want to say that if there's a parent who's worried about content in a book that they don't want their kids to read, they already have the means as a parent to prevent their child from having access to that book in the public school. So we don't need anybody coming into the public schools and removing everyone's right to access a book or piece of curriculum simply because one parent doesn't want it for their child.
549-2937, Kendra in Mandarin. Hi, Kendra.
Good morning, Melissa. You know, as an educator, it feels as though Governor DeSantis is playing a game of let's pretend. It feels, as an educator, that he's trying to enforce public policy that prevents teachers from teaching accurately. It almost feels as though he's trying to play let's pretend that gay students don't exist, that America does not have darkness and patches of darkness in its history. And it is incumbent upon teachers to teach correct and accurate history and lessons and to include social emotional growth for students. And it is absolutely necessary for students to receive a rigorous and accurate education. Thank you.
Thanks for your thoughts. And We are getting lots of calls now as we talk about the new group, Public School Defenders. We'll go to a few more in a minute, but first, Dr. Jen Cowart, you know, we do hear a lot from educators about this because, of course, they're on the front lines of this battle. They're in the classroom.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I'm grateful to Kendra and the public school educators that educate all the children across our county and across our state. My daughter is in public education. My son will be next year. Like I said, I'm the product of public education. I'm very proud of that. I believe it's really one of our great privileges and rights as Americans to have a free, fair public education. And when we make it harder for teachers to do their job, we make it harder for them to know what the rules are, to even know where the lines are drawn in terms of what they can and can't say. When we make them afraid to teach, you know, all she said, accurate representations of history. That's all any of us want. Teach true history and facts. When we make that harder for teachers and we make them afraid to speak the truth, and then, of course, the pay issues and everything that goes along with being a teacher, it's a very hard job. The harder we make that job, the more teachers churn through and they quit the profession. And then it's easier to keep pushing through more and more and more changes like this because teachers will not have been there as long. They will feel afraid to speak up. And so I want to, again, stand up not only just for the rights of my kid, but the rights of kids across the city and the county, but also the ability of teachers to teach. They went to school to teach. Librarians went to school to know how to pick books for a library. And we should allow these professionals to do their jobs in a highly professional way without this kind of interference and fear that if they choose accurate and factual curriculum, that they could be in trouble in some way.
More Facebook comments. Katie says, please vote in the primary election on August 23rd. There are 3 school board seats on that ballot. Research the candidates, folks, and vote your conscience either way. 549-2937, Ed, along NAS Jax. Hi, Ed.
Hi. My question is, I think we forget that the reason, number one reason for the so-called Woke Act was to keep our children from being what I call guilt by association or guilt by genetics, where they are somehow responsible or made to feel guilty over something that maybe their ancestor did 150 years ago. That was obviously a bad thing they did. I don't think we should go ahead and blame kids today in this current time for somehow they're guilty because of a crime or a bad thing that their parents or grandparents might have done. Maybe they killed somebody. We don't do that. We separate the idea of guilt. Children's are guilt for the things of the parents. You still, of course, want to promote and let it be known what the guilt is, what happened. But you're talking about promoting or saying the historical facts. I don't know of any history book, including in college, that says things like the fact that the Democratic Party was found specifically to defend slavery, while the Republican Party was the abolitionist party, that there wasn't a single slave owner in the United States who was registered Republican.
I didn't learn that in high school, Ed. I did learn it in college, though.
Well, I'm telling you, but you see the history book, and when you see an article even on the paper condemning that type of rightfully so events that happened, the word Democrat created, like Jim Crow, never appears. So let's teach history correctly and say who did supposedly all those horrible things which they did. And I can tell you, those of us who are legal immigrants who live in totalitarian regimes, I can tell you the government can put indoctrination in anything, including math. So let's keep teaching math and English and languages and science without putting any type of political thing. Because you know what? The Republicans and the conservatives could do the same thing. That's something people forget. Why don't we go ahead, the Republicans, introduce tiny things to promote the Republicans or conservative cause in the classroom. I think that's wrong, too.
Thanks, Ed. Dr. Cowart.
I appreciate the perspectives of the caller. I do want to just say I'm, again, a proud public school grad, and my AP history lessons in Texas were very thorough, and I believe we definitely learned that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican president who was very proudly pro-emancipation, absolutely 100% agree with history being an accurate representation as being very important. Now, I will say I'm a white parent. My kids are white. I don't believe that they feel guilt for slavery that happened 150 years ago, but we do teach them that there are ramifications from slavery and Jim Crow that act even into this day. So we try to teach them about redlining and the lack of access to other programs that have kept people who are Black in our country in more poverty with fewer opportunities that compared to folks with more privilege, and that includes themselves. I'm not trying to make them feel bad about themselves. I want them to understand why our country looks the way it looks today. I do also want to say this, quote, Stop Woke Act, as it was called, placed a lot of restrictions on private businesses. Private businesses, including small businesses, right now are really struggling to figure out how they enact this unfunded mandate from the state government on their own internal curriculums, processes, and policies. So I think there's something really to be said for looking at what our state government is passing as regulation and restricting small businesses and private businesses and how they conduct their own internal affairs.
With all of that said, we appreciate you sharing your insights with us. For people that keep asking, find Public School Defenders Duval on Facebook. Founder Dr. Jen Cowart. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll tell you why residents on Amelia Island are speaking out against a proposed development there on virgin forest, they say. But up next.
Our structure was based on what are called recovering peer specialists. And what they are is people who have either attempted suicide or have had severe depression and are in therapy, but they have turned their lives around.
How a unique peer-to-peer model at the beaches is preventing suicides. That's after this. Well, it's called Here Tomorrow, a new center at the beaches focused on suicide prevention, and they have a unique peer support model. For more, I spoke with founder and board chair Joe Kenny and internationally recognized suicide prevention expert and author Paul Quinnett. Hi, guys. Good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for making us part of this.
Joe Kenny, let's start with you. You're the founder of Here Tomorrow, and this began with the tragic loss of your son, Gary, to suicide. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us about Gary.
Probably about 5 years ago, Gary started having a lot of problems with depression and just became a recluse where he just wouldn't leave his condo, and I'd have to knock on the door for 30 minutes or an hour for him to finally come to the door and talk to me, and he would ultimately say, Dad, it's my life. Okay, you got to give me a, let me live my life the way I want to. And which is the worst thing that a father or parent could go through. And then finally, one day he reached out and he said he needed help. And so we sat together for 3 days talking about what we were going to do. And he moved out of the condo, moved in with me. And the next 3 months were great. He lost 60 or 70 pounds. He started to turn his life around, and then he just said, Dad, I have to move out, and I need to have my own life. And he moved out, and very soon after that, he took his life. And I tried to get him into therapy. I tried to get other people to talk to him. And I even went to a therapist myself and tried to have them teach me how to be them so I could talk to my son and how I could help him. And I just never could find any help out there, anywhere, no one to talk to, no one that he would talk to, that he would accept. And so I lost him. And at his funeral, I decided I'm going to do something different. I am going to find an answer for this, and I'm going to save somebody else's daughter or somebody else's son by finding an answer to this problem.
And I'm so sorry that you lost Gary, and I'm so glad that you found it here tomorrow, because this is a public health epidemic. Suicide rates are up, particularly among young people in this country. How does Here Tomorrow reach out to help people?
We started, it'll be 2 years ago in July that I hired Hannah Hackworth, our executive director, and her and I sat down for 6 or 8 months to put a program together. And part of that program came from meeting a fellow by the name of Paul Quinnett out on the West Coast, and very fortunate that he's one of the most renowned psychologists in the world, and he agreed to talk and tell us what he thought we needed to do. So we put a structure together, and our structure was based on what are called recovering peer specialists. And what they are is people who have either attempted suicide or have had severe depression and are still fighting it and are in therapy, but they have turned their lives around. And that person became who what we call our friends would talk to. And hence, that's what I was trying to be myself as a peer, which I didn't even realize that. Because I was trying to train myself to be that for my son. And that's what these people are doing. And the second level of that is then about one third of the people we're working with actually do need therapy and need a higher level of therapy. And we found a way to get people in with a therapist in 1 to 2 days, with the average being, from what I understand, 33 days to get someone in therapy. Well, when someone's suffering and someone's in severe depression or considering suicide, you don't have 33 days.
Right. And of course
everybody's
not.
Answer to me, right, everybody's answer to me was, Joe, that's just the way it is. I'm not very good at that's just the way it is kind of thing.
And I'm so glad that you didn't accept that. Well, let's turn to Paul Quinnett now. Paul, it's good to be with you. You are an internationally renowned suicide prevention expert, author, clinical psychologist. You've invented a form of therapy known as QPR. It stands for Question, Persuade, Refer. Can you tell us about this treatment modality and how it's being applied here in our area?
Well, it's actually not a therapy. It's explicitly not a therapy. It's a case detection system, as it were, a public health way for ordinary citizens to be trained in a CPR equivalent for a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. So we train people to recognize distress, symptoms of depression and other forms of distress, and we teach them to recognize and respond positively when they see suicide warning signs, which can be expressed in any number of ways, behavioral, or people could say something or write something, indicate that they're in great distress and desiring to be dead rather than alive. And so the QPR method is just like CPR. You see someone in distress and you apply this technique. It's really, excuse me, it's really a public health intervention, much like CPR. And what we do in that is to identify that person and have a chat with them clarify that they are in fact thinking about ending their lives, and then we assist them and advocate for them and get them into therapy with someone, a professional if we can. But as you know, the waiting lists are terribly long and services aren't available. So when Joe and I chatted a couple of years ago, I said, well, what's missing in our approach to mental illness and people suffering from a very serious depressions like Gary did? They go through an experience where they begin to be so hopeless. They think there is nothing that can ever make them feel better, and no treatment will work, and there's stigma around seeking mental health care, especially for men. So there's this dilemma of people in great pain and wanting to end that pain through death by suicide, and no one's there to help them. So about 70% of the people who die by suicide never got care, never got any help at all, never got a single session with somebody who might be trained to help them survive that bad patch of road and get better. So when we talked, I said, you know, you want to fill the gap. The gap is right there. It's right in front of you. It's Gary times thousands and thousands of people. So they stepped up and put the program together. Our part of it was simply finding new cases. And we have people all over the planet now training others in this QPR business. And so we're detecting lots of new cases of people that need care and need help, but we're running into the mental health manpower problem. There simply aren't enough therapists to treat all the pain in the world, and there probably never will be. So we're figuring out how to use the employ people like the people that work here tomorrow in peer support, and they've been there, they know what it's like, and they're very relatable for people in distress.
And that's the magic of it, isn't it? This peer support network, it's a different model than people might be thinking of when they think of mental health treatment.
Yeah. The peer support training has been widely available in the States for some years. I think there's 3 or 4 or 5 national programs, and they do now in the mental health service delivery system. They are reimbursable by Medicare or Medicaid. So they do have a growing role in the delivery of mental health services. And a lot of the time, you know, people in distress and considering ending their lives simply need somebody to talk to, somebody that understands, that can be compassionate and caring and not reject them or ridicule them or make them feel worse in some way.
Sure. So with all of that said, Joe, people who need help or people who want to volunteer can get in touch with you at Here Tomorrow at the Beaches, yes?
Absolutely. And there's no cost to anybody for anything we do for them, including therapy or coming in for daily sessions with some of our peers or our therapists or our group meetings and things. And there never will be any charge to them.
So if you or someone you know is hurting, contact Here Tomorrow, a mental health collaborative in Neptune Beach. Go to heretomorrow.org for more. And thank you, Joe Kenny, founder and board chair, and Paul Quinette. Good to have your internationally recognized expertise here on the program as well. Thank you both so much, gentlemen, for being with us.
Thank you very much. This was great. Thank you. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks so much. Spread the word.
Well, a proposed development on pristine Amelia Island has many residents there up in arms. Now, it could involve 11 85-foot towers, but opponents say it's proposed to be built on the site of the last virgin maritime forest on the island, a 50-acre site adjacent to a state park at the island's southern tip. With more about this, we welcome Amelia Islander Lynn Pinona on the line. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning. So tell us about this controversy on Amelia. What's happening?
Well, the last summer in June, the county commission passed a 45-foot height limit for any new buildings along the beach there. And the owner of the 50 acres filed what's called a Burt Harris claim against the county, or they gave notice that they would be filing a Burt Harris claim because they wanted to build those 11 85-foot towers.
And what's a Burt Harris claim?
The Burt Harris Act is a law in the state of Florida. And by the way, it's only in the state of Florida. That no other states have this. If a municipal body, a city government, passes a law that, and to use the term in the language of the law, inordinately burdens a piece of property, then the county or the city is supposed to reimburse the owner of that property. And this owner was claiming that to have an 85-foot height limit inordinately burdened them to the extent of $27 million. And that's what the controversy was. Our claim was, or the citizens claimed that that was not true, that there were no damages, because the only thing that the owner of that property was considering was building those high-rises. And yet, if single-family luxury homes along the ocean were built there with another row of single-family homes across the street from them, they could glean the same amount of profit, and we had appraisals to show that to be the case. So that's what the controversy was. And last night, it came before the county commission to vote on the proposed settlement, and we won. We were very pleased that over 300 people showed up, and there are never 300 people who show up at county commission meetings, believe me.
Yeah.
Almost 100 people signed up to speak, and they called the vote, though, after 32 people spoke. They didn't want to spend the night there, I guess. And the commissioners also said that they received over 507 emails, again, the most they said they had ever received on a single issue, and 51 phone calls. So it was quite an evening. It was entertaining to be there, if nothing else.
So what's the upshot, Lynn? What is going to get built?
Well, we don't know, and we don't know exactly what the next steps will be. We do not know if the property owner is going to go ahead and file suit under the Burt Harris Act, because what the county voted to do was to say, no, we're not going to bow to this claim that they're losing $27 million. The ordinance is going to stay in place, and we're not making any more concessions. So that's what the county's response is to that property owner. So now we have to wait and see. We have until, I think it's June 6th, for the 90-day time period when this is supposed to be worked out. And after that time period, we'll see if the property owner chooses to file a lawsuit against the county or not. It could be that they decide not to move forward. It could be that they do decide to move forward. But and if they do move forward, the citizens who were there last night will absolutely sue as well. So the county was in an awkward position in that they would find themselves either sued by this property owner or sued by their own citizens. So it was a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I guess. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the piece of land at the southern tip of Amelia Island where this development was going to be built, and why there was so much opposition to building on it?
Well, visualize, if you will, driving from Jacksonville up Heckscher Drive onto Amelia Island. And that's a beautiful drive. It's one of the most beautiful drives around. You pass by the Talbot Island State Parks and so forth, and then you cross the bridge. You have that beautiful view of the southern tip of the island, that lovely beach that's part of the state park, and then adjacent to the state park there along the ocean, next you see the 50-acre parcel that is as you said, virgin maritime forest. And after the state, after the 50 acres, there are some oceanfront homes, but you can't see them. They're invisible from the road. And this development would have meant that that tip of the island, instead of being as natural as it is now, it would have had those 11 condo towers down there. And even just as onerous practically, in the settlement that they had proposed with the county, they were allowed to signage that amounted to large billboards that were lit. So if you can imagine that as well, as you're driving up Heckscher Drive, you cross the island, and I don't know, every time I do it, I sort of take a, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air when you cross that bridge, and it just, it sort of has a calming effect, and all of that would have been gone. So that's what was at stake, and we're very glad that at this point in time, it seems that it will be protected.
We are getting emails about this story. Bill in Lakewood emails the show, I applaud the Nassau County Commission's decision to fight aggressive plans to defy zoning ordinances last night and their willingness to stand up to bullying tactics. Unlimited growth is the psychology of a cancer cell. Standing up to ravenous developers like this one is the only way to preserve the health of our human and natural communities.
That's exactly right.
And Amelia Island, let's be clear, is a unique spot on the map. It is a special place. Do you think that's why there was so much opposition?
I know so. Absolutely. When we've been just like, well, St. John's County and other areas here locally in Northeast Florida, we too have been burdened by overdevelopment and so forth. And the thing that's unique about Amelia Island, though, is we're a barrier island. We have finite space, and for instance, our trees are what hold the island in place. It holds the sand in place and so forth. And we need to be very careful about that. It's not, it's different. It is unique in that perspective from just looking at it from an environmental perspective. And then also another consideration for this particular parcel of the 50 acres, sea turtles nest there. It's a resting ground for birds that are migrating. Part of the that area is a critical conservation area that they close for certain months of the year during bird nesting season and so forth. So it's unique and very special in that regard. And many of the folks who have been born and raised here in Nassau County hold that beach access there and the fishing there and so forth. They hold that very near and dear and close to their hearts, and that means a lot to them as well.
Well, I appreciate the update, and I hope you'll keep us posted. Lynn Pannone calling in from Amelia Island this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Bye-bye.
And when we come back, a tasty treat as the Yard Milkshake Bar opens up in town. That's after this.
Climate change is affecting St. Augustine and how artists are using their work to push for solutions. Join ADAPT and Flagler College for Undercurrents, Cultures of Climate Change, a conversation with local officials, subject matter experts, artists, and students. This free event at the Chris Bellart Art Museum is on Thursday, June 2nd. Reserve your seat now at wjct.org/events.
On the next Fresh Air, comic, writer, and actor Sarah Silverman. She's known for breaking taboos in her comedy. She wrote about the most humiliating aspect of her childhood in her memoir, The Bedwetter. Wetting the bed was especially awful during sleepovers. Now the bedwetter has been adapted into an off-Broadway musical. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Nowadays, robots are helping ease the labor shortage faced by many of America's nursing homes. They can provide companionship, remind residents to take their medications, some can even crack a joke. But how far should we let new tech take over? Senior care and the growing role of automation. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Yard Milkshake Bar just opened up. It's a Shark Tank TV show winner known for its over-the-top milkshakes, sundaes, cookie dough, and other ice cream treats. Sounds delicious. Beth Duvall, one of the franchise partners, is on the line. Hey, Beth.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Good to talk to you. So the grand opening already happened at the Town Center this week. Tell us about this place.
Okay, well, we had a wonderful, wonderful grand opening on Friday. People came out and welcomed us. We are based, I'm trying to think, the Shark franchise started in Alabama, and Chelsea and Logan are the creators of the milkshakes. And when we went out there on vacation, we went to their store and fell in love with it. And we were like, we need to get this in Jacksonville. And that was what made us want to bring this family fun type of environment to our city.
Why did you fall in love with it?
Well, it's just a real fun, upbeat environment. It is just milkshake magic. It is smiles, not just on kids' faces, but it's also on the adult faces. It's just a nice place to get away and have a cool drink.
Now, these are over-the-top shakes and other treats, just
yes.
Really pretty impressive and big. Can you tell us what's on the menu?
Well, we do have a set menu with some already created milkshakes that are known for our specialty milkshakes. You can have it as a milkshake or as a sundae. And we have crazy things like a birthday cake, which would have a big old cupcake on it and made with like birthday batter ice cream, and we roll it in a jar and put sprinkles on it, then put the whipped cream on it, and it's quite the creation. And I love our little team that we've got trained. We've got little artists making little milkshakes and making big milkshakes. So different things like a old school banana split, which would be like an old fashioned, you know, banana split, but in a milkshake, cookie dough delicious. We do have things for people that are vegan, lactose tolerant. We have the not your milk, which is wonderful. Our vegan cookies are fabulous. But you can go big. You could take these milkshakes and bring them down to a bowl and still get the special effect, but not have the big mason jar. But when you really step back, I was talking with one of the customers, and I was like, you get a slice of cheesecake, an entire mason jar filled with milkshake, yumminess around the rim, all for $17.
No,
wow. So you can look at it as one to be shared, or I've seen most people eating it on their own, and you take the mason jar home so you can reuse it.
Cute. Now, this seems like a perfect summer outing to take the kids.
It is.
What have the families been, how have they been reacting?
The families have been excited. We've had so much excitement. We've really have had lines at the door. So what we discovered over the weekend with such a big crowd is that we really do have to keep the numbers down inside, which does create the line outside. But everybody that has been standing there waiting in line says it's worth the wait once they get their big milkshakes. Mm-hmm. And so we have all different, big families, small families, all different types of seating within the store to accommodate.
Now, you're at the Strand at St. John's Town Center to give people a picture. That's, you're kind of in between the Hobby Lobby and the Best Buy, if you try to picture some of the anchor stores. And you're part of a big expansion at the Town Center, lots of new places opening up. What's that like?
The Town Center has been wonderful. As I say, the side that we're on at the Strand, we have Chewy's right in front of us. We also have Cheddar's and right next door, the Grub. So there's a lot of good, just like places you can eat and then just walk across the parking lot and then grab a milkshake. Just staying in that one little area.
And, you know, with people more confident now about venturing out after 2+ years of pandemic, I would think there's a lot of pent-up demand.
Yes, I agree with you. I think it's a place you can go. I know it's a place you can go and just sit down and chill and get some happy milkshakes.
Well, check it out, everybody. It's brand new at the St. John's Town Center, the Yard Milkshake Bar. And this was a Shark Tank TV show winner. So it was put through the ringer, I guess, in terms of its business model, which I guess, Beth, is why one of the reasons why you chose it.
Oh, absolutely. Chelsea and Logan, who were on the Shark Tank, along with Allie, the three of them are very, very involved in their business and very passionate. And they have given, you know, you will not believe how we make these milkshakes. I mean, there's a whole line formed to do all this, and everybody's got their job. And it is that the end result is amazing. So, and tasty.
Check it out. Maybe this Memorial Day weekend, the Yard Milkshake Bar at the Town Center. Beth Duvall, one of the franchise partners. Congrats. Have fun with it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Heather Schatz can't wait to try, I think, the Orange Blossom Milkshake over there. Also, we might want to make it an outing with our whole team, including Catherine Hobbs, Josh Torres, Jessica Palumbo, news editor Randy Rogeski, and all of us here at WJCT News. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Stay cool out there and make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.